This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
There's a threat on the horizon so deadly that experts warn it could wipe out 9 in 10 Americans. The Pentagon, a former director of the CIA, and the American Society of Civil Engineers are all sounding the alarm. But nobody in the mainstream media is listening. This event has the potential to cause economic collapse, mass pandemics, and the complete and total breakdown of the food supply all at once. I'm talking about our nation's vulnerable and crumbling power grid. Fox News warns our death toll would be staggering if the grid goes down. I want to tell you about a free video that has everything you need to know about this threat and how to protect yourself. Watch it now at blackoutvideo.com. Go to blackoutvideo.com and watch this controversial video right now. If you want to survive power failures and blackouts, you need to see this video. Go to blackoutvideo.com now.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, thank you so much for joining. Welcome to another period here in the Freedom Hut. Period makes it sound like we're in school, but you know, another session. We'll call it another session, a Freedom Hut sesh. Thank you so much again. The Broad Voice line is open, 888-900-3393. So, while the media is very focused on some very unimportant things, some critical things are actually happening. Short way of putting this is, watch what the other hand is doing, because there's been so much focus and coverage on what Rudy Giuliani has said. And while many of us, I know, are, feel a bit of a lightening of the load to hear somebody speak what they believe is the truth about the president's strange proclivity to constantly denigrate this country, criticize this country, talk down to this country. While that may feel good, and there's a bit of catharsis in that, keep in mind that also the media's got other ulterior motives here. They're playing games. They've been playing games with Giuliani, who they're going to use now. They're trying to use him, trying to take those comments as a means of tainting other individuals, right? They want as many important conservatives as possible to have to speak about what Giuliani said so that then they can start screaming racist, and that taint can linger for a while. That can be a problem. Once one has been tainted with that brush, it can be, or painted with that brush, it can be a very difficult thing to just wait for it all to come out in the wash and to lift. There's also the Scott Walker situation. You have Scott Walker being asked about whether President Obama is a Christian. Apparently, this is a very controversial issue, which I find rather surprising. I think, actually, I've said many times here before that the president's actions all indicate that he is an atheist, and that's a straightforward proposition that I'm ready, willing, and perfectly capable of backing up if need be. I didn't realize this would be, but of course, then it opens up the accusations of, again, racism, otherism, as they refer to the efforts to make the president seem as he is part of the other, foreign, Muslim, whatever it is. These are the accusations that are thrown out, when actually I think it's in many ways a more charitable explanation of the president's actions when you look at his administration's continuous assaults on people of faith and on the church and on life issues. It's very clear. And again, apparently I was in the forefront of this. You can go back and I've said the president is, to me, I would assume, an atheist many times, but I'm not running for office, and I will never have any plans to do so. Scott Walker is. Scott Walker is the governor of Wisconsin, and he also is now not just doing pretty well, he's doing very well in what is a very early stage of the race to be president of the United States, to at least be the Republican nominee. In fact, there's a poll out of UT that shows that in Texas right now, according to UT, Scott Walker is neck and neck with Ted Cruz for favorite presidential candidate. So Texas is Cruz land. It's pretty impressive that Scott Walker has managed to even pull up, I think it's 20% and 19%, according to that UT poll, which was just released. So they are in a dead heat for Texas. And you can imagine that it's probably very close in other states in the Midwest, and certainly in Wisconsin, you would think Walker has a large base of support. But then we get into the why. You see, because the media's been so focused on this, and I know that they have been going after, for example, O'Reilly. They have also shown themselves, by the way, to really believe that there has to be a sort of tit-for-tat here. There has to be a partisan retribution for the Brian Williams takedown, which really happened. It happened because of Facebook comments. Keep that in mind. This was not the right wing coming in and saying, well, Brian Williams, we had a research team. We did some oppo research on Brian Williams. No. People served in the military got on his Facebook page and said, you are a big liar. And then that became the narrative, and it took on a life of its own. But that they think that somehow getting O'Reilly is retribution for Williams, clearly many of them believe that Williams was a staunch advocate of the left. Not openly so, but a sort of Trojan horse for the left. And so that's where this need to go and get a scalp from the other side comes from, going after O'Reilly. Those of you who are concerned, don't be. Mr. O'Reilly is going to be just fine. He will handle this just fine. But when you look at what they've done with Walker, you see there's all of these narratives now that are dominating the media, and you're not hearing about what matters, and you're also not getting the subtext here. Let me give you some subtext on Walker. He was asked about whether President Obama is a Christian, and he said, I don't know, which you would think is a non-controversial and pretty straightforward answer to an incredibly stupid question. Who cares? Who cares at this point? What does it matter what Scott Walker thinks about President Obama's religious belief? I'm somebody who thinks that it's okay to keep your religious beliefs personal and private. That's okay. You're allowed to do that. But they wanted to see if they could get Walker in a gotcha moment. And that's why. And then this follows up, of course, on the evolution question as well. All of the trap questions that are often posed to Republicans or conservatives. You don't see these on the left, by the way. You know, when was the last time John Kerry or Nancy Pelosi walked into a meeting somewhere and someone said, hey, so you're a Catholic. What's with the being a staunch and continuous advocate for abortion? Can you explain that to me? When was the last time that in what should be a friendly interview? At Chatham House, for example. That just doesn't happen. So we know there's a disparity. I'm not here to whine to you about the bias of the media. We all know. It's important to point out, and it's kind of fun to point out, too, because there's such a bunch of hypocrites and phonies. But, you know, where would we be if Brian Williams hadn't crossed the Delaware with Washington? I don't know. But Scott Walker, this is an interesting one, because it's too early for them to really be that worried about him, I would think, as a presidential candidate, although the fury of the left certainly knows no bounds. But let me tell you something else about Walker that's not coming up here. And one reason why you should understand that there is, even apart from his possible presidential aspirations, there's plenty of reason for the left to really dislike Scott Walker. And I mean the institutional, the hard left, the edifice of the left, the sort of progressive core. Why do they hate Scott Walker so much? And of course, that spills over into journalists as well, many of whom now, the ones that you see at sort of the national political level, grew up with the storied history of labor movements. Labor movements. Let's talk about that for a minute. Unions. Let's talk about unions. You see, while they're trying to make Scott Walker seem like some kind of ridiculous rube who is a bit racist, if you believe the Daily Kos, by the way. They've already dropped the race card because he said, I don't know about Obama's religion. And religion, by the way, is changeable. Somebody could wake up tomorrow and decide, you know, I don't believe anymore. I have left the faith. So the notion that you would say, I don't know about a person's private religious belief is completely and utterly defensible in every context. I don't know. There are priests who leave the faith. There are priests who are like, I'm just not in this, I'm done. And of course, there are people who say, I have seen the truth. I am now saved. And they completely change their life and they can change their worldview. It can happen in a day. So why this? Oh, he didn't say Barack Obama is a, you know, foreign born Muslim and all the stuff that's being, they're trying to insinuate that is behind this. But he didn't say anything like that, and he didn't insinuate anything like that. So why do they hate Scott Walker so much? Why? They hate Scott Walker because of what he has done to unions in Wisconsin. Now, I know that sounds like it's overstated from the get-go. Could they really care that much about labor unions, particularly public sector unions, government employees who unionize, and create an unholy alliance between Democrat politicians who need campaign donations and these unions who, if they can't be ostentatiously paid by the taxpayer, their benefits certainly can be very rich. Their benefits can result in bankruptcies, as we've seen, of entire municipalities, of entire cities. Unions can be a very destructive force, too. And in recent decades, we've seen they have been. But public sector unions, nobody, in the earliest days of unions, even FDR himself, public sector union, this is ridiculous. What do you mean? You're going to work for the government? You're going to get the wage the government pays you. You don't want to work for the government? Don't work for the government. There's no such thing as government exploitation of government workers. You don't like it? Don't do it. It's pretty straightforward. The taxpayer should come first. It should be the minimum number of employees needed to do the minimum number of essential tasks. That's how government should run. But, of course, that's not what happens. And what we've seen is the public sector unions are now a very powerful and influential political force. And people have assumed that they're not going away and that they're essential. They're essential to getting Democrat politicians elected. Their size in terms of membership is one thing. Their potency in terms of raising money and applying political pressure is vast, and it is essential to Democrat control of Congress, of the White House, of state governments, you name it. They need this stuff. You see, Walker passed an anti, what Walker pushed for, and then, of course, passed an anti-union law 4 years ago. And you'll recall that they seized the Capitol and they acted like Occupy Wall Street gone even crazier. And it was because they saw what was coming. There's a piece in the Washington Post over the weekend that was bemoaning the results of Walker's move to limit union, public sector union, a collective bargaining powers, but also, of course, to make them pay a little bit for their health care. Everybody else has to pay a little bit for their health care. Why can't public sector unions pay a little bit for their health care? A very good question. Well, now they do. And as the Washington Post said, as a result of that change during Walker's time in Wisconsin, public sector unions have not just shrunk, they have, quote, been crippled. The state branch of the National Education Association once had 100,000 people. Its membership has dropped by a third in 4 years. The American Federation of Teachers, which organized in the Wisconsin college system, has seen a 50% decline. The 70,000-person membership in the state employees union, the single union that knew they were going to get hit the hardest, state employees, they have dropped 70% since Walker's reforms. Now, of course, there have been givebacks to the taxpayers. They have seen drops in rates. They have more in their take-home as a result of all this. There's been benefits for taxpayers in Wisconsin, as well as for businesses that are trying to start or continue an operation. But for unions, this is completely unacceptable. And for the left that requires these unions to be able to force donations and then use those for political clout, this is completely unacceptable. The Walker experiment in Wisconsin, imagine if this gets expanded out across the country. What if other states decide to follow suit? This is in Wisconsin, not in Wyoming. This isn't in the reddest of the red. This is in Wisconsin, the birthplace of American progressivism. And unions have been clipped there, trimmed back, not just trimmed back, as it says here, crippled, according to the Washington Post. This is a national fight for the media, and there's a vendetta here. There is a vendetta because there's a recognition that one of the most important power bases for the left is threatened directly, not just by the Walker success story, but by Walker himself, if other states follow suit. And if he becomes president, or he even makes a good go at the presidency, this institutional power of the left is in jeopardy. 14 labor unions were among the top 25 political campaign contributors in the last cycle, according to National Review. There were 3 public sector unions among the 14 labor groups, and in total, their combined contributions were $150 million, or 15% of the top 25 organizations' $1 billion in donations since 1989. public and private sector unions contributed 55.6% or 552 million of the top 25 organizations' contributions. They need public sector unions. And Walker took the fight to them. That's why they hate him so much, and that's why they'll do anything to take him down.
Buck Sexton.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level.
The Blaze Radio Network.
What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at TheBlaze.com.
The brilliant diplomats of the Obama administration, the negotiators, the same people who brought you the red line that didn't actually exist, and of course their removal of Assad's chemical weapons stockpiles, which has resulted in, oh, we've gone from 100,000 dead at that point in time to about 250,000 dead in that war. So I suppose we should be thankful that they're at least dying from conventional munitions and not from chemical munitions. That's what the Obama administration would want us to believe, that this is some big victory. Not really clear on exactly what the moral grounding is for that kind of analysis. But now we have the possibility of an Iran nuke deal. And oh my, there is going to be a lot of chin wagging and back patting coming your way pretty soon from this Obama administration. They're going to be so excited about this if they can get this thing done. Now, it's not completely finalized, but we're getting the details. The early details are leaking out, and we are being told that here's the basics of it. So you have Iran. Now, let me give it to you in the context that I would offer you this deal, not the way the administration is going to propose it. So you have Iran, a country that now is in de facto control of at least five capitals across the Middle East: Tehran, Baghdad, Beirut, Sana'a, Damascus, partial or total control via proxy of those five cities. It is expanding its influence despite the sanctions. It has engaged in decades-long campaigns of support for global terrorism and has the blood of U.S. soldiers on its hands because it thought it would just be a good idea strategically to create chaos and murder throughout Iraq while we were there trying to stabilize the country. And now you have people who turn around and say, hey, let's use Iran as an ally. And it's just hard to fathom why anybody would think that would make sense. But that's the country we're talking about here. Also, of course, a theocracy that says that it wants to wipe Israel off the face of the earth and says that we are also a part of this evil cabal. And we are, of course, the great Satan and death to America and all the rest of it. But if we just sit down with them like pals, shake hands and say, hey, mullahs, what do you guys need? Let's make a deal. Everything will be better. So the Obama administration now is saying, and President Obama, of course, leading the charge on this with Secretary of State John Kerry. If you're talking about somebody that's really got a lot of diplomatic acumen, John, don't get stuck in Iraq, Kerry is the guy that comes to mind for me. But here's the deal, as they're putting it forward now. Iran will more or less get to keep everything it has, and we'll phase this out over a period of 10 years. So we're going to have a deal over 10 years with different benchmarks and such that there'll be some places where we loosen sanctions and where Iran is able to get some relief. But they keep their stuff and they have promises to only keep enrichment at a certain level. Now, this, of course, has already very much angered the Israelis, who are saying, you guys have got to be kidding me, right? Instead of just kicking the can down the road, you are punting the can all the way down the road and saying, I'm sure by the time we get there, everything's going to be fine. That delay is the same thing as a good deal. This is what they're offering now. That if we just make sure that the horizon is very long, you know, this is sort of like saying, let's reduce emissions by half for the climate by 2050. Who's going to enforce it? Who knows? So when a president says, we'll balance the budget by 2025, really? You're going to control all those future administrations and tell them how to spend or not spend? I don't think so. So we have this deal that's supposed to go out for 10 years. And by the way, at the end of the deal, Iran will be a nuclear threshold state anyway, and they will have replenished their coffers. They'll be able to build up their infrastructure. They'll be able to get relief from the international sanctions that are currently really hampering their economy. And by the way, they'll be at the tail end of a process of being part of the international community, sitting around and talking. So there'll be a sort of at least veneer of legitimacy to this state. Let me ask you this. If in 5 years, Iran says, yeah, we've got enough foreign reserve currency now and we're looking good, we're just going to go nuclear, do you think we'll be more or less likely to really do something about it? And do something would mean a series of airstrikes against nuclear reactors. You think we'll be more likely or less likely in 5 years? You think we'll be more likely or less likely in 10 years? Time for the Iranians very clearly is on their side. But for the administration, this is about legacy. This is about Obama's worldview. This is about no longer having a White House that looks like a bunch of fools. And if they get a deal, they're going to wave that paper in our faces and say, see, peace was possible. Then at some point, Iran's going to say it was possible. But now we have a nuclear missile. What are you going to do about that? Any answers?
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton Show, 888-900-3393.
Broad voice lines are open, my friends, 888-900-3393. Love to hear from you. Team Buck, as I am fond of saying, light it up, please. There was one bit that I didn't get to. I usually don't jump back to a previous topic, but I just have to on this for 1 second, and it'll be quick, and then we'll move on to our next, probably a continuation of the Mideast talk. But on this notion of public sector unions, because this is a meaty topic. I got a lot on this, especially as somebody who used to work for the federal government. You know, Parks and Rec has its last episode tonight. And I will tell you, I love that show. I think it is a hilarious, very well-written show. If you have not seen it, it's on Netflix. You can watch the first 5 seasons or so, I think. It's just an excellent show. It's very well-written. And it's also pro-government, and I don't want to be that guy that sees government messaging and everything, but, you know, there is a lot of, look, all you have to do is watch the Oscars. There's a lot of politics at work in our arts, to be sure. And in fact, it's, if you want to be at the most sort of elite level, you have to push certain things. For example, you have to push, if you're doing a sitcom, you definitely want to push gay marriage, and you probably want to push transgender issues as well. Now, that's sort of the cutting edge. And you also want to push sort of multi-person parental units. So, you know, 4 people, 3 people taking care of a baby. And this is what we're all heading towards, right? This is what they say. And be it as it may, that's what they're trying to do now. They're trying to sort of create the lay the groundwork for this to become, in a sense, normalized and expected and defended all along the way. And the arts and the media play a very large role in changing those perceptions. Parks and Rec, though. Now, we all love Ron Swanson. And if you're not familiar with Ron Swanson, you have to watch the show just so you can see Ron Swanson. Man's got great hair, both on his head and on his upper lip. And he knows what time it is, so to speak. He knows how to get down. Works for the government, but hates the government, which is a fascinating situation. And it's true, by the way, of a lot of government employees that I know. But see, Parks and Rec is propaganda in a sense, because at the heart of it, you have a character. And remember, I love the show and I recommend you watch the show. I can separate my politics from my entertainment, even when it's being inflicted on me anyway. But you should definitely check it out. And like I said, the season finale is tonight. But the main character, Leslie Knope, is someone who is just obsessed with doing the best job possible and providing the best parks for her community, and she loves the American people, and she loves American history, and government service for her is a lifelong dream, and she sits up at night doing her reports on her own time, all this sort of stuff. Let me tell you, that is, for the vast majority of federal employees, and I can't speak to local employees with quite the same personal experience, that is a huge lie. Now, I don't mean, look, there are great people working for the federal government, of course. But I'm telling you, even the ones that work for the good agencies, the ones that we need, A lot of them sit around and they complain endlessly about how they're underpaid and, you know, there's morale issues. And, you know, I have friends, for example, at DHS, and I know people at all FEMA and all these different agencies. And they all kind of think that they're underpaid because to get into some of these places is sort of a difficult process. You need a certain kind of degree, and HR departments tend to be a little rigid with what's required. I mean, I got into the CIA without having a master's in international affairs or related field, which is not supposed to happen. But, you know, ninja skills, what can I say? There are other people, though, friends of mine at these different agencies, they get in there and they go, well, I had all this fancy education. I have a master's. And this is public record. I mean, the GS scale stops somewhere in the neighborhood of just shy of $130,000 a year of base salary. You can see on Drudge right now, there are almost almost 19,000 people who work for the federal government, 17,000 people, rather, who work for the federal government who made over $200K last year. Now, if you're a doctor and you're working with the federal government, you have real experience. I have no problem with you making real money. And if we want a better VA and we're going to have a VA, you know, for example, we need talented MDs who are willing to work. But anyway, willing to work for the federal government, I mean. But Parks and Rec is a great show, but the funny thing about it is that this whole Leslie Knope character is a total fiction. That when you spend time in various government offices and bureaucracies, you get to see that people, by and large, are constantly complaining about how much they're paid and looking, always sort of trying to get, because the incentive structure is different than it is in the private sector, right? In the private sector, excellence is rewarded. In the public sector, showing up is rewarded. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people who, for reasons of mission or patriotism or service, aren't exceptional at what they do. But I'm just telling you about federal agencies in this country, here at home, the different departments and all the expanded, you know, EPA, and just think of all of them, Interior and Commerce. And I know people who worked at all these places. They all think they're underpaid. They know they're not overworked, but they're sort of complaining about the work that they have to do most of the time. And they never think about the fact that it's almost impossible, short of doing something illegal, for them to be fired, that even in a recession, they won't lose their jobs, and their benefits, they believe, should be locked in. But meaning that it can't change. You know, you can't, nothing can be altered, and they should get pay increases and on all the rest of it. Now, for some of the federal agencies, there's, like I said, there is an important mission. You know, you want good people. You want good people at the FBI. You want the best people you can get at the FBI. You want good people at the Department of Justice. And so you need to have competitive salaries, and I get that. But I'm just telling you that, by and large, the incentive structure is you get more by doing less when you work for the government. This is just the truth. I worked in the government. I know. I can tell you that the people that are getting the most value from their labor are the ones who show up and do the minimum. You have to at least do the minimum. And the smart ones establish what that is and then try to sort of game the system as much as they can while staying within the system so that they get paid and don't get in trouble. You don't want to get in trouble. There are places, you know, especially a place like the CIA, they'll boot you for stuff. But as long as you know what the rules are, you can sort of skirt around the edges of them all the time, as long as you stay within them. And it's a great gig. You don't have to work that hard. You kind of just do your thing. And, you know, it's, even the CIA, there was sort of a self-selection that occurred. They're the people that want to find the easiest account as an analyst, the easiest account they can work on. They have to do the least amount of research. They don't have to go to any scary places or put themselves in jeopardy. And there are people that are just, you know, how can, you know, deploy me as soon as you can so I can go help the SEALs. Put me anywhere you want as fast as you can so I can go help special forces or whatever. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that also happens, right? But that's the tip of the spear within the agency. That's the, within the analyst corps. And that's the minority. That's what I'm trying to tell you. So the Leslie Knopes of the world, the people that are like, I work in government and I love this and I'm up at night thinking about this and this is all I want to do, are few and far between when you look at the aggregate number of government employees that there are. And I don't necessarily even blame the employees who are a little more slothful, is a little mean, but complacent. That's the word I want to use, complacent. Because the way that the government structure is set up is that it's all time and grade. How long do you spend doing this? People show up wanting to be Leslie Knopes, and they end up being, I don't know, well, if they end up being Ron Swanson, that would be amazing. But they end up being very disaffected and no longer thinking that their mission is essential and that what they have to do is important. And then they just want to get their paycheck and go home and not be bothered. These are the people, by the way, who are going to be increasingly in charge of your health care and in charge of your privacy, in charge of internet regulation. These are the people that are making those decisions. People that show up to work and are like, oh, I should have taken the private sector job. I'm so underpaid. Oh, gosh, can I have a flex day? I'll take off next Friday because, you know, it's normal to take off a day every other week or, you know, whatever. This is the kind of stuff that happens. And this is why you don't want government in charge of more of your life. You don't want to be reliant on government employees because their incentives as individuals who are working for their own self-interest are not really aligned with yours, especially at agencies like, what do you even do here? Like, what would you say you do here, to borrow from Office Space? You ask a lot of employees that at different government agencies, and they're like,
I'm here, and I file reports, and, if anyone needs anything.
I mean, that's pretty much the job description you get. So I think that that's something you should keep in mind, and I also think you should watch Parks and Rec tonight if you haven't before. Well, it's the finale, so maybe you should catch up. But still, if you ever watch it, you should check it out. I think it's a great show, and Ron Swanson is one of the great fictional characters on television. And you got to respect a head of hair like that. There was one thing in the Washington Post piece, by the way. It was talked about a meeting between teachers at a sort of teachers union hall in Wisconsin. I just want to read you this part of it because this really says it all. Another teacher, Linda Zahner, 58, said she was working to build a case that teachers wanted to keep the same benefits, but she had struggled to get teachers to respond to a survey. She said she wanted to emphasize that teachers still thought of health care as a, quote, bargained right. This is the closest we're going to get to negotiations, Zahner said. Fish, another teacher, remained incredulous. You have to be mean, she said. We never get anything by being nice. We've had to walk out. We got things when we banged our fists on tables. Classic union stuff. Then Bray, another teacher, jumped into the conversation. Sometimes I think, she stopped to collect the words delicately. Sometimes I think that's why they came after us, Jenny. Because they thought these teachers were too demanding. No, we have to fight, Fish responded. It's for our students. Oh, okay. It's for the students. You're fighting and banging on tables and demanding benefits as a right from the state, from the taxpayers, for the students. I don't think so. Just like I always say, be careful of the government when it says it's for the children. Be very careful of teachers when they say, my benefits are all about the students.
Buck Sexton will be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show. Speak your mind. 888-900-3393.
Broad voice lines are open. Give us a call. Happy to hear from any of you, Team Buck. Please do give us a ring. Okay, so we're T-minus 2 days away from net neutrality becoming a reality. And I did not intend for that to rhyme, but there was no escape. This is going to be, as I'm seeing it now called, the transfer from the internet to ObamaNet. Excellent piece, by the way, in the Wall Street Journal by Gordon Krovitz on this very issue, getting into what's really happened here. There are so many similarities between what happened with Obamacare in a lot of ways and what happened with this in terms of how it was sold to the public and then rushed through. Just like Obamacare, net neutrality, which is what the president was always talking about. And by the way, the president has been way too involved in this. FCC regulatory issues are supposed to be separate and distinct and apart from the White House. President Obama has been very involved in much of this. But just like Obamacare, he said that this would be, if you like your plan, you could keep it. For example, if you like the internet now, it's not going to change. That is a lie. That this will be, just like with Obamacare, this will be cheaper. It'll be cheaper care, better care for more people. That is also a lie for Obamacare. It's a lie for the internet as well. You see, Obama sold people on the concept of net neutrality and then called something net neutrality that was actually a massive government regulatory takeover of the internet. It's sort of like saying, let's deal with pre-existing conditions. Okay, let's deal with pre-existing conditions. Okay, we all agree on pre-existing conditions, right? That people shouldn't be priced out of the healthcare market and just suffer and be bankrupt because they were bored with some kind of a disease. We all agree on that? Okay, great. Let's pass a multi-thousand page bill that doesn't even definitively answer many of the questions it pretends to and leaves a lot of discretion for bureaucrats and is unconstitutional in its scope. But wait, but we all agreed on pre-existing conditions, right? Same principle here with net neutrality. Net neutrality, right? We all want the net to be neutral, right? Everyone's agreed. Okay, let's pass a 300-plus page regulatory decision without anyone knowing what's going into it that treats the internet like a telephone monopoly based on the 1934 Communications Act. Let's do that. Wait, you don't like that? Net neutrality, bro. Net neutrality. Wait, but no. You don't just get from one to the other. That's what they've done here. It's really a bait and switch. And that's why even when I brought this up initially, I got to say, I was on the earlier end of this issue with you here in the Freedom Hut. Much of conservative media has been talking about it since. I said, look, this is not good. This is a big problem. The moment that government is increasing its regulatory authority such that it's able to make these decisions without any oversight whatsoever and can, under the framework that it's given itself, regulate whatever, regulate prices, regulate fairness, all this stuff. Regulate what practices and charges are, quote, just and reasonable. That's price controls. That's speed regulation for the internet. That's what they're giving themselves the right to do here. Oh, no, but what, you just want the big internet providers to be able to throttle some people and others? No, but you can deal with that problem without dealing with all the rest of this. You can manage this one issue without giving authority to manage every issue. Just like with Obamacare. Okay, we'll keep kids on their plans till they're 26. We'll deal with pre-existing conditions. Let's do that. That seems, well, the 26-year-old thing is not so much. But pre-existing conditions, let's deal with that. Oh, but let's pass all this other stuff, too. Let's pass a medical device tax. And just there's so much in Obamacare that no one even knows about yet. And then we'll keep changing the goalposts and making sure that no one really knows when or how this thing is going to be implemented. Understand that big government and big business are very, very good friends. They like each other a lot. And particularly this administration, despite all the sort of Marxist twang discussions about inequality and wealth redistribution, this president and this administration love big, powerful business. As long as that big, powerful business is squarely on the side of an enlarged bureaucracy and government with more and more power, gives them the money they need to win the elections to get that power. See? It's just at the federal level, at the national level, what we see at the state and local level with public sector unions, except in this case, it's not unions, it's big business. Big businesses that are going to be operating de facto monopolies with the consent of the federal government. This is not good, my friends. This is going to change the internet, and it could be unalterable.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, thank you so much for staying with me into hour two. Very good of you to stay aboard the Freedom Hut Express. Choo choo. 888-900-3393 is the broad voice line. I think I need to work on my choo choo train. I have to add that to the list along with working on a Hillary impression. Gonna need that one, my friends. Let's take Tom in Boston. Tom, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
How you doing? I'm up to my eyeballs in snow.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, but hopefully you're inside and warm.
Yes, I am. And the trains over here don't run that good because of the snow. You know, we're having a lot of problems.
Fair enough, sir. So what's on your mind, Tom?
Okay, I saw an article, it was in the Daily Mail online or whatever, and it was talking about, it showed a video and a few pictures, and I I put one up online, and it showed ISIS training these kids that could be like Cub Scout age.
Right.
And I'm just wondering what the purported terrorist camps that are, you know, that are rumored to be in the United States. I'm wondering if they could be doing similar things in there, meaning because what they do in Africa is they take the people out, they take the young kids and they recruit them into the army and their service.
So, Tom, there's a couple there's a couple layers, I think, to your question. I mean, the first one of ISIS using children in their propaganda and, in fact, showing children both in training and engaged in acts of terrorism themselves. This is a longstanding process and this is a longstanding procedure that terrorist groups have been engaged in. This is something that's not new. Even when you look at groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, they have these sort of youth cadres, and they have often shown, you'll see, there'll be photos of children who are told that they want to be a martyr like some family member, and they'll dress them up in a little mini suicide vest and they'll take photos of it. And the brainwashing of children into being jihadist martyrs and into being jihadist killers, that's not new to ISIS. That's happened with other groups like ISIS across the Middle East, stretching back for decades. And with ISIS, though, it's just more pronounced because they're really so involved on social media. You know, some of these groups, you know, Hamas and even Hezbollah sometimes like to pretend that they're a little different in some capacity than, say, the worst of the worst of the jihadist world, right? That they're a little more reasonable, that they're state actors and not just a bunch of savage terrorists. And so they're not necessarily as willing to show, for example, a little kid holding up a severed head, which ISIS is. But that doesn't mean that they don't make use of children in their propaganda and that they're not willing to train kids, because they do. They absolutely do. And Hezbollah and Hamas both have sort of youth brigades that they work with, and they're training kids to be part of that fight. Now, as to training camps here, I'd have to see the piece or whatever you're referring to with specifics. I'm not aware of any children being trained here for the purposes of jihad. So I'm not saying it couldn't happen. It's just not something that I'm aware of. But I mean, this is also something that can happen in the home, right? If you have a family that has radicalized, you would assume that the children would be part of that process, or could be part of that process too, meaning that they're indoctrinated from a very young age. But Tom, stay warm up there in Boston, and thank you very much for calling in. Let's take Bart in South Carolina. Bart, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. Sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your podcast today, or your live cast. So I'm only going to talk about something I heard you say yesterday.
Sure.
And you sounded extremely optimistic about the average, I guess, life expectancy, that it's up near the 77 years.
Could I just insert one thing? I'm optimistic, or rather, I think that, yes, life expectancy is going to continue to expand. I'm not optimistic about our ability to, without major disruptions, deal with that. But go ahead. I just wanted to put that in there. Go ahead.
Oh, well, in that case, you'll be glad to know that I think that we're not going to have those issues you're talking about, because life expectancy will drop.
You're going to have to sell me pretty hard on this. I'm not convinced. But to go ahead.
Well, then if the life expectancy today is 77 years, let's say, that actually says a lot more about when those people were born than about when they died. They were born in the 40s and the 50s. America was a much different country back then. There wasn't this abundance of sugar and crap in our diet and stuff. Now, it doesn't say anything about the welfare or the diet or the general well-being of the people who have not died yet. We will not know what the life expectancy will be of the people who are currently in your age group, in my age group, 30s and 40s.
Right. Well, these are obviously projections for the generation. I mean, they don't know when people are going to, on average, die. But yes, that's true. It's a projection. So,
and also, I mean, the caller who called in yesterday, I think it was Jason from someplace, he pointed out a few things to you about the percentage of people in the United States who are obese, but he, the, and things like that. But he failed to mention the fact that more Americans are coming down with autoimmune diseases, cancer. Every projection for the same cancer is up for the near future. You know, now it's, I think, 1 in 3 women is apparently having breast cancer. In like 10 years, it's forecast to be 1 in 2 women. So
that sounds a bit high to me, but I'd have to look at the statistics.
Maybe it's a little bit high, but I don't remember the exact numbers.
I think it's smaller. I think it's considerably smaller than that. But still, look, if you're telling me that you think that we're getting unhealthier, I would say to you that without even engaging in the debate about whether we are unhealthy as a people or not, medical advances and advances in technology and food and just being able to feed people, I think will balance out even. I mean, for example, now, even if you are really overweight and have health issues as a result of that, we are better equipped now medically to keep you alive and going longer than we did before, right? I mean, whether it's through some kind of cardiothoracic surgery or something, I mean, there are ways that they can do things. Also, you know, in extremis, I know people can have a gastric bypass and that's expensive and it's a big procedure, but still, there are things that can be done to keep people alive longer than there were in the past. I think that it's unlikely that we're going to see a drop in life expectancy because of those things, but we are definitely going to see. You see, where I come at it is, this doesn't mean, Bart, that people are going to be dying younger than the previous generation, but it means that they're going to be unhealthy and very costly for their medical care longer than the previous generation. Meaning that I do worry about, just based on, because when you look at the trend, right, if we had a graph, if you look at a trend of life expectancy, it is without interruption for the past 3 generations going up. Okay, that's just, I mean, I looked at the graph yesterday, so I can tell you that it's going up without, there's been no aberration in that. But if you look at the graphs of some of these diseases you're talking about, heart disease and obesity and type 2 diabetes and such, those are also just going up on the graph without aberration. So I think, you know, we can agree that at some point there's a crossing of those lines. And what does that mean, right? I mean, at some point, if one of them goes too high, the other one's going to start to dip down. I don't know what that looks like or if that's going to happen, but I also hope that advances in what people know about food, you know, I mean, just, and by the way, there are many of you in the audience who are much more expert about nutrition than I am. I mean, you know, I really like brie and chocolate, but, and Bart, thank you for calling in, buddy. I appreciate hearing from you on this. For example, the fact that when you look at the food pyramid, I mean, not to get all, yeah, not to get all crazy to you guys here, but when you look at the food pyramid, I remember looking at it when I was a kid, and it said something like 6 to 12 servings of grain a day. Now, as somebody who's celiac, me, I have to say that to me is crazy. And the notion that they were trying to feed us processed carbohydrates and stuff that has long life on the shelf, and now that's just, people agree, that's just wrong. And that was FDA guidance. I mean, this was I remember being a kid in school, 6 to 12 grains, servings of grain or pasta? Bread? This has zero nutritional value. It is nothing but calories and turns into blood sugar very quickly, as you know. White flour. This is all bad stuff. So dietary guidelines in the 80s were wrong. That is not controversial. That is just fact. And that eggs, and I credit my mother with always being on the forefront of this, telling me eggs are good for you. Don't listen to this stuff about how eggs are high in cholesterol. Eat eggs. Eggs are good for you. Human beings should be eating eggs if they're not allergic to them. And now, of course, as you've seen, there was just another study that shows that eggs in no way raise cholesterol. That's crazy. And so some of the conventional wisdom has not just been disputed. It's now been completely thrown out about diet. And what I think yesterday, and I got a little pushback. And look, I like pushback, especially on these areas where I'm very upfront. Look, on any area, but I'm very upfront that on some of these areas, I'm giving you the best opinion I can based upon the facts as I've been able to gather them and just my own, you know, weirdnesses. But for example, when Jason called in yesterday and we're talking about people being obese, my objection is not the fact that, you know, well, yes, of course, they're showing lots of statistics that show that people are more overweight now. And when they even look at us versus our European counterparts, for example, or Asian counterparts, we are, as a people, considerably heavier and larger than they are. That's mostly dietary, right? That's what that comes down to. But I also just think it's unfair when, especially as somebody who has spent part of his life as what I not affectionately refer to as being a cube farmer, when you're stuck in a desk, I mean, we have a society now that is, especially now, very chained to our desks, right? We're constantly sort of told that we need to be in the office, be at work And it's not easy to adjust lifestyle necessarily to be incredibly healthy when you're supposed to be sitting for 10, 12, 14 hours a day. I mean, it's one thing if you can show up for 5 or 6 hours and then go home, right? But I mean, if you're working at a desk more or less for 8 or 10 or 12 hours in a day, it's hard to then say, you know, well, I'm going to be really healthy the rest of the day. And I think that the way that work happens now, we're getting into some habits that are, we're more sedentary. And I just think that blaming people for that is harsh, especially also when we see that food is particularly cheap, that is high in sort of stabilizers and preservatives and sugar, right? So they're constantly, the food industry is constantly not making us, but trying to push on us, you know, as much Wonder Bread and Fruit Loops and all this stuff as humanly possible. And a lot of fast food purveyors and such are making up for with quantity what they should be doing with quality, right? So you get your, in Parks and Rec, they talk about paunch burger, and it's just like this quadruple stack of burger with all this stuff. It actually looks pretty good. But, you know, instead of focusing on something that's really tasty and satisfying, they want to give you a lot of fillers and crap. So I just think it's a more complicated issue than telling people, like, you know, have some discipline. If you're I see these actors, for example, in Hollywood, well, if my job was to work out for 2 or 3 hours a day and I didn't have to be in an office and I could take a little HGH hormone on the side, by the way, as a lot of them do, then yeah, it's pretty easy. But for many of us who are sort of running around, trekking to the office and having to be in an office environment, I mean, I guess I could start banging out push-ups in the middle of the conference room, but people might think that was a little weird or awesome. Maybe I should go do some push-ups in the conference room. Broad Voice is open, 888-900-3393. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at theblaze.com.
It's funny that we're having this discussion in the Freedom Hut about nutrition and exercise and how to fight obesity, which is an epidemic in this country. I mean, the numbers show that. It's something I've been thinking about more recently. I actually did my first CrossFit class on Saturday. Now, I'd done something similar to CrossFit when I was deployed at one point because there were some guys who were doing it and we would do PT together. But this was sort of the official no nonsense. This is a certified CrossFit situation. I was in a box, which is what they call a gym. I had a coach, which is what they call a trainer, and they're going through some of the movements. The only hesitancy I have is the concern that I really don't want to slip a disc in my back doing a clean and jerk right before we're supposed to launch the hour-long Buck Sexton TV show. So that's the only... And also I had a lot of discussions about the paleo diet with some of the people at this particular box, again, is what they call a gym. I will say that based upon friends of mine that I've seen that have adopted a semi-serious CrossFit lifestyle, right? And maybe not totally paleo and maybe not, you know, going to the CrossFit gym 5 times a week, but hitting it a solid 3 or 4. The physical transformations are, and these are people that I know, this isn't like I saw an ad at 2 a.m. like, oh, like, just put this weird plastic thing on your stomach and it'll make you have a six-pack. No, this is actually people that I know who have been able to transform themselves. And the science of it makes sense to me, the idea of hitting large muscles, engaging lats and gluteus, and making sure that you're building sort of that framework for all the rest of your muscles as well. So anyway, I thought it was very interesting. And I will say that, you know, in the gym... This, because I belong to a normal gym outside of CrossFit, you know, a normal person gym. In the gym, you see everything in New York where I am here, from literally fitness models to people who, you know, they get there once every 6 months. And most of the time they just read People magazine while they walk on the treadmill. In a CrossFit box, pretty much everybody there looks really serious about it. There's no dilettantes. There's no sort of halfway. So anyway, I'll update you if I decide to go all in on that. But if I have to do a few Buck Sexton TV shows coming up here with one of those sort of collar things around my neck, you'll know why. I'll try not to get injured. I'll go slow. I hear that that's not an issue as long as you've got proper coaching. So we'll see. And we'll see how that works. All right, let's take a call from Tommy in Sacramento. Tommy, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
What's up, Buck? I want to talk a little bit about the cells here at home, you know, and that they're, I mean, from what I understand, I've done some research and they're training in most of our backyards, you know, in big training facilities. And it seems like everybody's looking the other way. And at the same time, trying to take our defenses from these people away, you know?
Now, Tommy, where I got to jump in here, and I want to be fair to your position and your comments. So let me try to unpack this a little. What large training camps? I'm not familiar. You know, when I was at the intelligence division of the NYPD, we would, for example, occasionally get reports of, and this was true, there would be groups of young Muslim men who would go and get, as a group, combat training, and they would say concerning things and talk about how, like, oh, well, this is how, you know, if we ever did wage jihad, like, it would be good to know this. And now that's not, you know, they sort of, nothing they do necessarily that's illegal, but obviously it raises people's concerns and suspicion to some degree sometimes, depending on what's said. I'm not, where are these terrorist training camps operating on U.S. soil? None of them are jumping to mind.
Jamaat al-Fakra is the one that keeps coming up. There's one in Squaw Valley, California. There used to be one in Valladolid, California. Is what they named their own town, but then they killed some cops and got ran out, literally vanished overnight. And there was a documentary, and there's literally video of these guys. Most of them are Nation of Islam, and apparently they're allegedly funded by Hamas and Hezbollah. There's videos in this documentary of them shooting AK-47s with 30-round magazines that are illegal in California. But the group itself is Jamaat al-Fakra. That's the one that, like I say, it keeps popping up. And they're talking about giant training camps in Tennessee, purchasing huge swaths of land in Texas. And all this money is coming from the Middle East. You know?
You mean Jamaat al-Fakra?
Yeah, you got it. You got it.
Yeah. I will look into this group a little bit. I know, look, there are paramilitary groups of Muslims that have, look, I know that exists. I just don't want to overstate the level of training that's gone on U.S. soil. Look, abroad, there's no question. There are these terrorist training camps operating in a bunch of countries, and I could talk about that at length. But here at home, let me look into this a little bit because I'm not.
You will be surprised, Buck.
On the NYPD side, we were focused on New York and its environs. So that's Tommy. Thank you for calling in. That's understand that that's not necessarily national in scope, right? Because we're worried about defending New York City. And so I'm familiar with all the cases against New York, which is some of the biggest terrorist cases, and worked some of those cases. But most of my counterterrorism experience is abroad with the CIA and international stuff, not stuff here at home. That's more FBI, DHS territory. So before I go too deep into any training that's happened in U.S. soil, let me look into this a bit. I'm always honest with you about what I know and don't know, Team Buck. All right, 888-900-3393. Let's talk about Saudi Arabia, maybe?
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck, you got more calls coming in here. I was going to talk to you a bit about pensions.
I know, it's exciting, right? Hello, ladies. Let's talk about pension reform. Dun, dun, dun.
But I'm going to hold off on that for a second. Let's do John in, and I may rethink it, actually, now that I'm completely mocking my own choice of topic. Let's take John in South Carolina. John, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Buck. I was calling in because the fellow who called about life expectancy had a lot of errors in his understanding of that. Life expectancy, when you say it's 78 right now, it actually means somebody who's born right now has a life expectancy of 78 years. It constantly changes throughout your life. For instance, in ancient Rome, at birth, your life expectancy was 21, but if you made it to age 5, your life expectancy became 42.
Right. Infant mortality was a huge, huge problem, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Right, and it changes throughout your life. For instance, I'm 60, so I was born 1955. So let's say, I don't know exactly, let's say my life expectancy at birth was 66 back then, but now I've made it to 60, so my life expectancy may be to 73. And my parents, who were in their mid-80s, you know, they've passed that 78, so their life expectancy may be to their late 80s. But if they make it to their late 80s, then their life expectancy may change to the early 90s. So it's something that fluctuates, and of course it's also based on economic and environmental and social factors, too.
But do you believe the trend will continue to go up, meaning that overall the trend line for life expectancy for, let's say, starting in 1950 and taking it to 2050, is it just going to continue to go in one direction, or are we going to reach a point at which because of either dietary issues or new diseases or what have you, that there may be a drop essentially? Because it really has been going in a straight direction, or straight up rather, for a while.
Yeah, I don't think anything can keep going up forever. You know, things turn around, they will turn out to be limiting factors. You know, just the survivability of just basic body organs and so many other factors that, you know, we can't even begin to anticipate in the future. But I don't see any way it can keep going straight up. It's not a natural phenomenon for anything to have that kind of a graph.
Right. Well, it may level off. What I was referring to more is do you think that there'll be some aberration where all of a sudden there'll be a drop in life expectancy? I mean, I worry, you know, not to, if I'm going to start telling everybody about my neuroses, you know, I do worry about antibiotic resistant bacteria. And that's something that I've heard from legitimate, renowned experts on, who say that it's one of those things that maybe we shouldn't worry about it because, you know, it probably won't happen. But if that gets really bad, it could be, we could be back in the era of, people having illnesses that are essentially untreatable the way they were before antibiotics, and that could really hurt life expectancy. I mean, you mentioned for children, for example, you know, childbirth was so dangerous for the mother as well as for the child, and that was a major hurdle those first years in life. I mean, we've conquered largely childhood mortality in a way that I think 100 years ago nobody could have even really, well, maybe a little more than 100 years ago, but nobody could have even really imagined it. But John, anything else you want to share?
Well, I was going to say, you're absolutely correct with what you just said. I'm a medical doctor, and the antibiotic resistance is such a great concern for us. The overuse of antibiotics in our society is such a major concern that it's going to change things, because pharmaceuticals are just not able to do the kind of research that they were in the past because of all the limitations placed on them.
I've heard that, John, not just from doctors like yourself. And Doc, thank you very much. It's always cool to have an MD call in. Thank you very much for your expertise and for sharing your thoughts here. I've heard from others as well who are just sort of in the pharmaceutical industry and who have expertise in what it's doing. And the problem, one of the problems that it has, as it's been explained to me, and again, this is me presenting to you expertise of people who have, you know, PhDs in, I don't know, whatever it is that they need, microbiology, whatever it is they need for to know pharmaceutical stuff. But that's how deep my expertise is. I don't even know what their expertise is in this area, but I've heard from people who know that a lot of the big pharma companies now focus on innovation in the delivery mechanism for the product. So what you used to have to take as a shot, now you take as a pill. What you used to have to take as a pill, now you take as a cream. What you use, you know, and it goes from there and there. But it's the same substance, really. Maybe there's a slightly better intake of it, depending on how you get it. But the same basic chemistry is at work. Not let's try this this new way to cure, for example, strep throat or some of the more standard things that right now everyone just assumes you go to the doctor, they're going to be able to fix this. If that goes away and the main classes of antibiotics that we use don't have real efficacy any longer, we're back to sort of the pre-antibiotic era, which means that now all of a sudden, you know, you get a staph infection and you might be a dead man or woman. You know, you got to be careful when you're shaving in the shower all of a sudden. So that's something that I think, you know, when I'm talking about how things, you also have the possibility, and I don't want to go there, but, you know, you also have the possibility of the life expectancy curve dropping, as it certainly did in Europe at various times in the 20th century because of a massive cataclysmic war. Now, I'm hoping it's only Tuesday. Let's not go there right now. I'm hoping that's not something we have to worry about in the future, but you never know, my friends. Let's take one more before I probably go into a break here. We got Paul in California. Paul, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Buck, you said you were going to talk about Saudi Arabia. I just wanted to warm it up a little bit. You know, Hillary got caught with her fingers in the till here, you know, taking hundreds of millions of dollars from the Saudi Arabia. She's taken a total of $2 billion into her nonprofit. And you know these people want something in return. They expect things in return. And this points to what I was saying to you before, how Saudi Arabia is basically, and what your earlier caller was saying too, how Saudi Arabia is just buying up our media and they're buying up our politicians. It is no coincidence that Obama went and he bowed to the king in Saudi Arabia and he didn't go to Paris. And the fact that he is bowing to the king and yet he is dissing Israel in every way. So he's taking a Saudi Arabia point of view and he's bought off the same way because he's in the same camp as Hillary. And Hillary's taken hundreds of millions of dollars from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, as I said before, owns 44% of the media in France. Well, they own a certain percentage of the media here, especially the left-wing communist media. So we're being bought and sold. And as far as the camps go, there are several camps. And you know, the FBI knows about them. They've been featured on Fox News. And that earlier caller was right. There are several training camps going on. So that also was.
I know there have been. I'm just not clear on what their status is. What their status is now. I mean, I've heard of Islamberg,
AK-47s, Buck. They carry AK-47s and they train on a regular basis. The Fox featured them. There's about 30 of them. All of them were carrying fake. All of them were carrying real AK-47s, and they were training in military ways. And you know they're well known. I mean, you can Google it, and it's a real thing. But he's selling. The problem is that Obama's selling us out like a used car salesman. You know we owe 23% of interest goes to China. You know, we completely fund their military just with the interest that we've borrowed, and that's to fund all these illegal aliens and all this welfare. We owe 20% of our debt is being paid to Japan. So you know we can't even afford the interest that we're going into debt in, and yet we're still taking on another 20 million, 50 million illegal aliens, and that's simply to buy those Democratic votes. You know, anyway, I've taken
all right.
Airtime.
Thank you. No, it's okay. Thank you, Paul. We're gonna let the train come to a gentle stop there, but thank you very much, buddy, for calling in. As always, a lot to. I just let that air out for a second. That was Paul, everybody. Paul from California, laying it down, touching on about four or five different subjects. Well, we have Paul calling. It's sort of like Pardon the Interruption, the sports show, where they're like, let's talk about Kobe. Okay, let's talk about off-season baseball. Okay, let's talk about, he just hits him. One after another. Bam, bam, bam. Let's talk pension reform. I'll talk Saudi Arabia tomorrow and also immigration. I know we kick around topics sometimes here, but, you know, we're always kind of freestyling. I'll be back in a minute.
888-900-3393.
You're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton.
So I want to talk about pensions just for a second here. You know, we've been talking about life expectancy and health and all of that, but also what's interesting is there's a disparity between public and private sector when it comes to pensions and pension planning. It seems that now, and it's still, by the way, a problem for some of the larger, because large companies tend to have defined benefits plans, so they have pensions that they have set up. And they're trying to find ways to limit their exposure to these because, again, people are living longer. And those pension plans can be a drag on quarterly earnings for these large companies. But, of course, if you're a pensioner, you're like, bro, this was the deal. What do you mean you're trying to change this up? So there's that. And this is in the private sector, right? So there's that tension. In the public sector, of course, rather in the government sector, Social Security and these things, that's what's going to be interesting because there's not the same – willingness to deal with this. I mean, companies have seen for a while, and that's why they've been pushing everyone onto 401k plans, and essentially you're on your own for retirement now in the private sector, by and large, now, today. And good luck with that. You also can't get any return on savings, which is something that no one talks about this anymore. You used to be able to build up money, put it in a savings account, and get some kind of a real return. And over time, it could grow and compound interest and yada, 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 and you got some money. Now you put money in a savings account, you're losing money. And every year, the IRS, with its grasping little claws, just wants more and more and more. Because, you know, that's going to make the country a better place. And of course, you know, that's a fair situation. So pension plans, though, are in a place where there's some degree of, you know, back and forth between these companies and trying to make sure that they limit their exposure from these plans. So that's something that I think is interesting, because we were discussing longer life expectancy. It's having an effect on the private sector, is the long and the short of it. And the balance sheets of these companies are having to reflect the higher costs of people living longer. You know, today, and to the point made by the doctor before, the Society of Actuaries, there's a way to get a date on a Friday night. Hello, darling. I'm from the Society of Actuaries. Oh, yes, that society. But they say that the average 65-year-old man today will live 86.6 years, and that's up from 84.6 years for a 65-year-old man just a little over a decade ago. So those additional years, while it's like, well, does that really make much difference? In aggregate, yeah, it does. It makes a big difference. And so companies are trying to struggle with this now, because they were assuming that their costs would be X, and they're actually going to be Y when it comes to defined benefit pension plans. Now, as you can see, the private sector is trying to deal with this, and they've been preparing for it. In the government, and with government plan, not government plans, with government pensions, which is really what Social Security is, there's no willingness to touch this or change this. And Social Security is not really where the money problem is for this country. As you know, Medicare is the biggest issue. Social Security could be made sustainable pretty within reason. It wouldn't be that hard. Medicare is a big problem and going to get a lot worse. And so these notions of people living longer, and also family and who takes care of people when they're older, this has effect on our wallets today and now. It has effects on the private sector. It has effects on the government, too. And the idea that people can predict the future is, of course, proven wrong all the time. And it's wrong even when it comes to retirement plans. Oh, speaking of retirement plans, President Obama he gave a speech yesterday at the AARP, and he wants to tighten regulations for investment professionals who are handling retirement accounts. The idea is there that they'll increase their obligation to customers' interest to a, quote, fiduciary duty, as opposed to just sort of like a more reasonable standard for investments and such. Now, here's the issue with this. And the president, you know, you get what you pay for to some degree, and a sort of more hands-off approach for some of these investment professionals means that you're generally not paying big fees. Now, the president's saying, well, people are being exploited here, and there are some retirement planners, for example, and financial advisors who are pushing you into things that they have some interest in themselves. Well, clearly that's a problem. But as we see time and again, when the government sees a problem and starts talking about it, what it often does is add a whole bunch of stuff that's not even needed for that problem and not fix the problem anyway. And calling for tighter government regulation of those who are directing private sector investments. Think about this now. The government has said, well, or by and large, society has said, you need to pay for your own retirement. We can't afford this anymore. And unless you're going to live on Social Security, this is the way it's going to be. And the government's saying, okay, well, you can have a 401k and we'll give you some tax benefits for that, but we're also going to increase now our regulations on this, because just increasing regulation, they think, is the answer to everything all the time, always and forever. I just think there are some issues here. This is going to be proposed by the Labor Department. Oh, yeah, that's great. You're going to have a bunch of Marxists in charge of regulating your investments for your 401k and for your retirement. I don't know. I've just been thinking that basically my generation, by and large, the millennials, and I, as I said, I'm a gray-haired millennial, you know. I'm an elder statesman of the millennials, but you young whippersnapper millennials, listen up. We're going to have to work forever, basically. I mean, the idea of retirement is just going to go away. You know, we're going to be, even if we're on some sort of a ventilator or something, we're going to be there with our laptop doing work for the man. You know, we're never going to be able to retire. It's just not going to happen. That's going to be a thing of the past, because of all the political pressures and financial pressures that it creates. So that was a sort of quick and dirty on all things pension and long-term debt obligation. And, yeah, some sexy talk right there. Laying it down. Oh, yeah, Buck Sexton with the smooth talk about the pension protection plan. I wanted to go into a happy thing for a second. Do I have like 30 seconds to do this? Okay, cool. Because when I was in college, I really liked manatees. Don't ask me why. I just thought they were a cool animal. In fact, my junior year of college, I had a manatee photo or like poster rather on the wall because I just thought they were really cool. They were like my favorite animal for a while. So 20 of them were saved from a rescue, rescued rather from a storm drain in Florida. So we're saving the manatees, which is cool. Be happy about that, everybody. Till tomorrow, my friends. Shield high.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.